Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Under the Hoodies. I am Bill Kegel. Brian, are you there?
Bill, how's it going today?
Oh, good, buddy, good. Had a little technical difficulties, but I think we're good. All righty.
In the nick of time, that was we had come through in the clutch. I don't believe in clutch genes, but I believe that was pretty clutch of you, though.
I tried. So, Brian, tonight we're going micless. We have no Mike Pazeski tonight. This is his wheelhouse.
Yeah, it's too bad because I know he's an avid college football watcher and, a heck of a host. So we'll certainly miss him, but, like the old NFL adage goes, next man up, right?
Exactly. So, Brian, we're going to be doing a little bit of NBA playoff stuff to start the show, and then a good chunk of the show is going to be NFL draft, and this is your wheelhouse, Brian. This is where you live. I get more intelligent. I've said it on the show before. I get more intelligent text from you than 99.9% of things I read and see, and by the people that are making 6-7 figures a year to do it for a living. You do it part time, and you're better at most of these people are better at that than most people. So
I greatly appreciate that, Bill. I greatly appreciate that. I do try my best, and it is something that I really, really enjoy doing.
Yeah, and it's just you're just a wealth of knowledge, and I look forward to hearing a lot of this. I'm going to learn a lot. I'm going to ask you questions essentially, just to give the listeners an overview. Basically, I'm just going to essentially interview Brian about the NFL draft. He's everybody listening, you just sit down, strap in, and get ready to listen to Brian just take everybody to school. But first, Mr. Shipley, I want to talk a little bit of NBA playoffs. The first round was absolutely incredible. We have 5 game sevens, a game 6 ended on a crazy play, and the Heat just going, just taking care of business, but it was fun to watch them do what they do best. LeBron dominating, D-Wade looking like Flash a little bit, Flashes as he's called now. So, what were your thoughts on the first round?
I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was like watching a movie where the whole movie is just so engrossing. The beginning's great, the middle's great. And then the ending was just a little disappointing where you wanted it to end a little bit more, a little bit more suspensefully, I guess, and then you wish the ending would have left you really, really satisfied your taste buds. And, of course, my analogy to this is that I thought pretty much all the series other than Miami, the Bobcats were fantastic, but those 5 game 7s or 4 game 7s, whatever you preface it with, I was chomping at the bit to watch those games, and, I mean, let's be honest, all of them were stinkers. I mean, the best one, was a ferocious comeback by the Toronto Raptors, so it made up for 3.5 quarters of really the Brooklyn Nets dominating that game. And obviously the Raptors cut it close, made it an interesting last couple minutes, so that one sort of sits by itself, and then the other ones were just, absolute blowouts, and really what I think everybody expected the superior team to do at the beginning of the series. It seemed like it finally took them that 7 games to get to it. And, that's why when they changed the format a few years back from the first round of 5 games to 7 games, it's a reminder that it's pretty hard to beat a better team over a 7-game span. Unlike a 5-game span, we would have seen multiple top seeds get knocked out under that format. What'd you think, though, Bill?
I'm just going to echo everything you just said. It was incredible. I mean, I think Damian Lillard doesn't hit a 27-footer to win a game. They were down by 2 points with 0.9 seconds left. I mean, the West, every single one of those games would have won game 7.
Right.
I think the Indiana, very close to being bounced. That was kind of shocking by a team that really had no business even being in the playoffs. And, they're possibly one of the worst teams to ever make the playoffs, and they took the 1 seed to game 7, and then that was incredible. I agree with you with the 5-game thing, man. I really think it would have been a lot more Indiana, I think, would have been out. I think, going by game by game, I think Indiana would have been out. But absolutely.
Same with OKC.
OKC is another one. And, speaking of that, Memphis. All right. I listened to last week's show that I was only on at the very end of the show because I was away on and Mike sort of called me out a little bit, and you know what, rightfully so. I've been beating the Memphis Grizzly drum for years now, and I did bail on him at the last minute. And you know what? Not that Mike was incorrect, because I actually deserved everything he said, all right? But man, if Memphis was playing, I think, any other team, I really think they would have won the series, other than maybe against San Antonio. But I don't know if losing Zach Randolph, if he plays that game, I'm very, very curious the outcome of game seven. But yeah, man, Memphis, I really hope they have another run at them next year, because look out, I really love that team. I think their coach Jaeger, he might have been a slight upgrade over Lionel Hollins, who got fired last year for unknown reasons, at least unknown to me. I didn't hear anything, you know, on ESPN or NBA Network or anything about why he was let go. I mean, the team, he took him to heights that team has never seen. So I don't understand that. But, yeah, man, I like Memphis. I really hope their window isn't shut. I really like to see them get a healthy Marc Gasol next year, because I think if he was healthy this year, they're a 58-61 win team. I think they're the two or the three seed, and I think they have a lot easier of a road to the Western Conference Championship in the finals had they had Gasol all year.
Right, and again, I give you a lot of props, because I'm telling you, Bill was the original bandwagon driver of the Memphis Grizzlies. I don't even think the Memphis Grizzlies believe they could be a playoff contender before Bill believed that they could be. That said, though, I got two questions for you. First, I just want to make a comment about that Lillard shot that you had talked about at the beginning. And again, that was a great shot, but it's funny because we were texting each other live during it, and I was like, man, I'm happy because you and I both like Lillard and like the Blazers. But I was like, I thought that was going to be the best Game 7 matchup. Those 4 or 5 seeds tend to be really, really good battles, especially against two not great teams, but two very good teams. And I was a little disappointed we had to miss out on that action. But my other question for you is I completely agree with what you said about Randolph. I just was so distraught the day before that Game 7 when I saw that the Grizzlies were going to be without not only maybe their best player, but also their leader. I mean, Z-Bo is certainly their spiritual leader. And my question to you is, not would they have won the game with them, but did you think it was an appropriate course of action for the NBA to make? And you think it might have been a little bit of an overreaction because they're afraid of getting more bad publicity in wake of let's quit giving that guy any more publicity, in wake of the former Clippers owner's action?
You know what? No, because I think the NBA is – I mean, I disagree with the fact that warrants a suspension, but they're pretty straight across the board when it comes to things like that. Like, you throw a punch, no matter how small, how big, or whatever, you're suspended. I mean, and they're pretty, like I said, they're pretty straight across the board. They don't really ever kind of deviate from that. They don't really take it. If a punch is thrown, you're suspended. That kind of thing. So, even I mean, if you're interpreting the rules, then the NBA was correct. But I actually don't really think it had anything to do with Donald Sterling. I think an incident, just to use an example, now I think if Zach Randolph got pulled over, you know, between Game 6 and Game 7 with a gun in his car coming on the heels of the Gilbert Arenas, why am I drawing a blank on his name? The other guy there, Jordan Crittenden. Now, I think something like that, I think those are the kind of things that the league and the media tends to overreact on when it comes to the quote-unquote thug mentality, but I think there are two separate issues. I assume that maybe at the time a little bit, that it might have gone the other way, because I think the players, I mean, kind of showed that they sort of run the league a little bit with how that whole Clippers owner situation worked itself out, and I thought maybe he'd even get a little bit of slack cut, you know, based on, this is guys that are supposed to be our responsibility. He's one of 30 owners in the league. So, you know, maybe we cut the players a little slack on this one, but it didn't happen that way. And unfortunately, Oklahoma City, unfortunately for me, because I love the Grizzlies, Oklahoma City, you know, were able to get past them. And I don't think that they would have had Randolph plays.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, Bill, I'm not a violent person, but Steven Adams, I mean, let's be honest, this guy has been had a punch coming his way for a long time here. So
absolutely.
I understand that, that Randolph should have been smarter, but he played at the University of Pittsburgh, obviously one of Syracuse's rivals. And I remember Rakeem Christmas, I think, was about ready to set him up with a right or left hook. I mean, he's about as laid back a player as you're going to see on the floor and just an all-around good guy. And when you see Rakeem Christmas ready to lay something to this guy's jaw, it's very unsurprising to see that even a grizzled veteran, no pun intended, such as Zach Randolph lost his cool. But it was just disappointing. And then, you know, not only did it hurt the Grizzlies, but it hurt just NBA fans without a rooting interest like myself that just wanted to see as good a basketball game as possible.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with all of that. Yeah, Steven Adams, if I think of a player, if there was a player's poll out there for the least favorite player amongst players, I definitely think he'd be towards the top three of that list.
Oh, yeah.
So
I hated him a pick. I thought it was a good pick by the Thunder in the draft because he does have some skills. But I hated him a pick. And I remember Syracuse lost that game, I'm pretty sure. In Pitt, which can be a very rambunctious arena. And I just remember turning it off and being like, I respect the Pitt program. I like Jimmy Dixon. But that tall foreigner is just really grinding my gears right now. But what are you going to do about it, you know?
Right. It's done. It's in the past. It's unfortunate. I mean, and I love Zach Randolph. I've liked him for years. He's just a super talented big man. And it's not a lot of tread left on the tires, but, man, I hope that team can make a deep run next year. I'm really, really looking forward to a Memphis Grizzlies title run next year. So, anyway, looking forward to the next round, Brian. What have you seen? Like, the second round has been wildly disappointing compared to the first round. I mean, most of the games have been, not really close. Washington, Indiana. You know, there's a little bit, but it's like nothing. I mean, you're coming down off that high, and then you got this game where it's a 4-point game, and then it's kind of a 6-point game, and it's just kind of like whatever. But what do you think about Washington? What do you think about their chances getting to the Eastern Conference Championship?
Not sure how I want to articulate this, but I just really don't care about Washington. I just think this is like being the hottest girl in a small town or the second hottest girl in a small town. I just think the East is so weak this year, especially since the Indiana Pacers did a 180, that just because in years past, it's like, well, you got to a conference finals, you're a good basketball team, you're a terrific year. And I'm not trying to disparage the Wizards, but I just don't think they're a very good team. I think they're a good team, but not a very good team, and certainly not a great team. And, yeah, they might get to the conference finals, but, I mean, really, on paper, it's like, wow, they beat a one seed that only lost 20 games and had a better record than the Heat. But let's be honest, this one seed has been looking like the New York Knicks lately. I mean, they just look – I've never seen a team do such a drastic 180 so quickly over a 12-month span. So I think the Wizards are a good team, but if we were doing a power rankings of both conferences, I mean – they might not even crack my top 10, to be perfectly frank. So good for them. Good for the city of Washington to have that team be good again after a guy you mentioned earlier, Gilbert Arenas, was sort of like their last hope to being a good basketball team when they gave him that max contract. And it's nice to see they finally climbed out of that hole and got a couple of cornerstone pieces, a couple of solid NBA vets that have given them the experience and the old man game that oftentimes is the difference between winning and losing a series. But all in all, I just don't think they're a very good team, even though they have some good building blocks. And right now, they certainly look like they could get to the Eastern Conference Finals. And I'm not sure how big of an accomplishment that is with this year's field.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, if you're doing a power ranking, you know, teams 1 through 10, they're 10th. It's every team that made the playoffs in the West. Now I'm even thinking about it, I don't even think they're 10th because there is how many other teams in the West that would have been a 3 seed or a 4 seed in the East. Like, it's kind of
right.
Absurd just how lopsided it is. It's Miami and who they're going to play in the finals, and it's just exciting to find out who Miami's going to play. Eastern Conference gives me nothing. And you know what's kind of weird about it is that the Eastern Conference is one player away from being interesting, and that one player is Derrick Rose, because I think if Bulls had a healthy Derrick Rose all year, that's an Eastern Conference championship to look forward to, but it just obviously didn't break that way. It's kind of crappy. I mean, I'm a huge Knicks fan, and I just like, I just feel bad. I was like, man, I really wish they somehow could have, you know, moved Melo, which I love Melo more than any one team. Thank you, Isaiah Thomas, for ruining my love of the Knicks. It's kind of a flawed relationship thanks to him. But yeah, man, I would have loved to see the Bulls have just that one score, and I really think that would have been a great, great Eastern Conference championship. I don't know. I mean, is it too early to make a prediction to come out of the West? Who do we think of the last four is going to go play the Heat in the finals, or do you want to hold off on that?
I don't think it's too early. I think I'd probably go with the Spurs still, just because I think Oklahoma City is really, really, really struggles if Durant and or Westbrook isn't on top of their offensive game. I like the Blazers, but I don't think they're going to be able to withstand Spurs over a 7-game series. So, and ultimately, I think I like the Spurs best in the conference finals. The Clippers, I think Oklahoma City will get them the second round. That's why I didn't even mention them. So I think Spurs over Thunder in the conference finals.
Yeah, I think we're going to get a rematch of last year. And if we can get an NBA Finals, like anything like last year's was, then I'm very, very, very excited for it, because that Game 6, I've never seen an ending to a basketball game like that in my life. Like, that was nuts. LeBron, he got his headband knocked off and just took over for 10 minutes. And then the final 2 minutes, everyone was saying, oh, LeBron's not clutch. There's no way they're even in that game if he didn't do what he did. Like, I've joked on the show before, too, like, in the gym, like, if I have an open gym by myself, I will find a way to try to figure out how Ray Allen did exactly what he did to hit that three. That still is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in sports. That just setting his feet, not traveling, catching the ball clean, getting a good shot, a good look at a corner three. I'll never figure out how that man did that. Like, it was absolutely incredible. I agree with you.
Shuttlesworth without hitting big shots, so let's be honest here.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good point. He took the Lincoln Rail Splitters to the New York State Championship with somehow Travis Master looked older than my dad. And who else was in that? Walter McCarthy and John Wallace, the great Cuse, great Orangeman. John Wallace was in that movie too.
My all-time favorite. That was the first name I got on a fake ID was John Wallace.
I love that. But yeah, I agree with you. Spurs Heat, man, and I'm looking forward to that final. So you guys are under the hoodies with Brian Shipley and Bill Kegel. No Mike Pozeski today, and it pains me to do this NFL draft stuff without him, because this, man, college football is his wheelhouse, and I know he's looking forward to talking some draft stuff, but unfortunately he couldn't be with us for reasons bigger than this show, Brian, and I will not say anything, but I'm rooting for the guy. That's all I'm saying. He's not in any kind of trouble or danger. I'm just rooting for him, and I'll just leave it at that. So we're going to try to do this without spending 45 minutes on Johnny Manziel, because we're not getting paid anything for this show, let alone tons of money by ESPN to talk about it. So we are going to keep the Johnny Manziel chatter to a minimum. And all I'll say about Michael Sam is he's a brave, brave man, and he deserved that courage award that he's going to get at the ESPYs. But he's not a real NFL, he's not a true prospect worth talking about, in my opinion. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I like Michael Sam's game. Watching him last year from Missouri, and I think he'll get his shot in the NFL. Probably, starting off as a special teamer and a guy that you might be able to bring in on 2-minute drills to just let him get after the passer. Clearly, we saw the Senior Bowl. He was not going to be able to cover running backs or move in space, so it's hard to see him as a 3-4 outside backer. I think his best chance for success is to sort of be that short, stout guy that just has a relentless rush, sort of like an Elvis Dumervil. That'd be the type of player, if I was him, that I'd be trying to look up to, a shorter guy that doesn't have the long arms, as good, Elvis has better speed than him, but not elite speed. And I would be trying to look at some of those pass rushing moves and just try to hone his technique as much as possible and try to make a living as a pass rushing specialist and a guy that gets after it on special teams.
All right, and that is the last of the Michael Sam talk for tonight. So that's from our expert, everybody. That's Brian Shipley. And you know what? I'm interested to see what he does in the league. But yeah, he's, you know, he – I agree with everything you said. I don't know if he's really somebody we're going to be discussing in 5 years as a solid NFL starting linebacker or DN.
Well, there was a report that as soon as he gets drafted tomorrow, there's at least a 75% chance that Richie Incognito throws a chair to this television set. So we'll have to wait to see if that holds true or not. But it will be interesting to watch, that's for sure.
I would love to see Richie Incognito throw his chair through his window and hit one of his Ferraris. That would make me even
happy. Yeah, there you go.
All right, Brian, let's get into it. We're just going to go position by position, and Brian's going to tell us I'm just going to give you a couple names in each position, and you know what? First, you've been really wanting to talk about this, and I actually do find it really fascinating. Running backs. I'm trying to look, see how you worded it to me. What did you want to talk about with running backs as far as their value? So I'm just going to let you go. You tell everybody your thoughts on drafting running backs. I really wish I could have thought of this. This is bad pod, by the way. Very bad pod. I'm forgetting exactly how you articulated it, but go ahead.
So basically the narrative surrounding the running back position this year is that it's much like the Willy Mammoth and dinosaurs, that it's a declining position that's being devalued because teams think that they can just get a guy from anywhere and have similar production. And the anecdotal evidence that people are using for that is that there's not expected to be a running back taken in the first round. The draft this year, for the second straight year, free agency saw a really weak market for free agent running backs. My response to that is, the free agent running back class this year was dreadful. I mean, there wasn't LeSean McCoy hitting the market, in his prime Maurice Jones-Drew hitting the market, Adrian Peterson hitting the market. And just like everything else in life, people are going to pay more for a superior product, a superior athlete, a superior player. And I think that if one of these really, really game-changing running backs hit the market, I think without a doubt the teams would have been more than willing to break the bank for him if they thought they were the missing piece. Moreover, if we go back to last year's draft, there was, I think, four or five running backs taken in round two. And I dare you to find me players that had more impact on their teams that drafted them. I mean, there's certainly a handful of them, your Sheldon Richardsons, your Kiko Alonsos, et cetera, et cetera. But off the top of your head, can you tell me guys that had a better rookie season last year than Le'Veon Bell, Eddie Lacy, Giovanni Bernard? I mean, even Monte Ball chipped in a little bit. Andre Ellington was a godsend for the Arizona Cardinals offense. I mean, running backs still make a major difference. And a lot of the teams that are quote-unquote smart, advanced, ahead of the times, a lot of these teams invest heavily in the running back position. Look at the Super Bowl champion, Seattle Seahawks, paid big salary to Marshawn Lynch, spent a fourth-round pick on a Robert Turbin from Utah State a few years ago, a very solid running back. And then last year they spent a second-round pick, despite having those two guys already in place, on Christian Michael, who, side note, was my favorite running back in the draft last year. They spent a second-round pick on him to further shore up the position. Same with the San Francisco 49ers. They pay Frank Gore big bucks. But despite that, that doesn't stop them from adding the Michael James, the guy from Oklahoma State. I'm totally drawing a blank on his name. They took him in the third round a few years ago, Kendall Hunter, excuse me. And, of course, last year they made noise by taking Marcus Lattimore. And then we look at teams like Bill Belichick and the Patriots. Well, where did he get his running backs from? He spent reasonably high picks on them. Shane Vereen was a top 40 pick, and I think people forget about that. And Stephen Ridley was a high pick. I mean, I just think this idea that you can just grab a running back from anywhere and he's going to instantly have success, I think Mike Shanahan ruined that for everybody, and it's just simply not true. I mean, if you're talking about a guy that can get you 3.8 yards in a cloud of dust, well, yeah, there's a pretty large contingent of guys out there that can do it. But when I'm talking about future running backs, I'm talking about a guy that can break multiple tackles, get to the first, second level of the defense, and every single play the defense has to account for him, because if they let him get an open space, it could be a major run like we see Adrian Peterson, Marshawn Lynch, LeSean McCoy, and the other elite backs make on a regular basis. And then lastly, to sum this up, I wouldn't be surprised at all if a running back won the first round this year. Let me just say that. But, again, people are saying, well, the deep value, that's why there's not a first-round, going to be a first-round running back. Well, no, I just don't think there's any great, great elite backs that are available in this draft. But barring injury, I'll make a bold prediction right now that next year there will be two top 15 backs that will go in the first round. One of them is maybe my all-time favorite running back at the college level, and Todd Gurley from Georgia, who I just love that man's game. And the other guy is T.J. Yeldon, the next line in the lineage of ultra-talented Alabama Crimson Tide running backs. I wouldn't be surprised at all if both of them were top 15 picks. And in fact, I'm more than willing to predict that that could happen next year.
Yeah, you're 100% right. I mean, the best free agent running back this year is Ben Tate, the oft-injured Ben Tate, who's a backup. I mean, a very, very good backup and a very talented guy. But, yeah, he was the best free agent running back, and that's why there wasn't a lot of money spent. You get a very old Maurice Jones-Drew. You know, you have, like I said, Ben Tate, who's injured all the time. And let me just say something about Christian Michael. I watched Christian Michael in preseason a little bit, and after you were beating that drum, I watched him on YouTube, and let me tell you, for a man that large, he's lighter at his feet than Darren Sproles at times. Like, it's a beautiful thing to watch that guy run. Like, he's going to be special, I think. Like, I made one of the funniest things I've ever heard, which is that Christian Michael why can't I remember friggin' Seattle starting running back's name right now?
Marshawn
Lynch. Yeah, oh my God, I don't know how I did. This is bad pod, Brian. You said he looked like a Harvard scholar, yeah, which is so true, because as I was watching these Christian Michael highlights on YouTube, I also saw where he had a second and 17. He gets a 6-yard gain and gets out excited, beyond all excited, and makes a first down signal with his arm. It's like, yeah, you still 11 yards ago, bro. So that was that was entertaining, but.
He missed his combine meetings from drinking too much NyQuil the night before. And just to wrap up this point, Phil, ask the Philadelphia Eagles if they think LeSean McCoy is easily replaceable. Ask the Vikings if they think Adrian Peterson is replaceable. Ask the Seahawks if they think Marshawn Lynch is easily replaceable. And the answer is going to be no, no, no. Ask the Chiefs. What did the Chiefs spend last year without an elite back in Jamaal Charles?
The MVP of the league, the non-quarterback MVP of the league in Jamaal Charles?
Their entire offense, the entire focal point of their offense. If you can give them the elite back, you can be a difference maker for your team. Give me this junk that is devalued. It's just people want, just like fine wine, they want fine running backs. That's just my whole argument there.
No, I agree with you. I think everything you said definitely is 100% correct. So, you know, while we're on the topic of running backs, we'll jump around a little bit. We'll jump back to quarterback. But I have a couple names that I wanted to get your opinion on. The first one is Carlos Hyde from Ohio State. What do you think of that guy?
I like Carlos Hyde a lot. Every game that I watched Ohio State in, he was easily, I thought, their best player on the field. The was an injury for a while for their starter. The backup came in and played well, but the foundation of their offensive tack was handing the ball over and over again to Carlos Hyde. And the other thing I like about him is that previous to playing under Urban Meyer, he played in a pro-style offense. So he's not your typical Urban Meyer running back that only knows how to run from that spread formation offense, which – you know, we just really, even though we see bits and pieces of it now in the NFL, a lot of teams don't run systems like that. So I think that he does have, you know, he's at least gotten his feet wet with a pro-style system. And, you know, most importantly, it's just very hard to find guys that are over 6 feet, 230 pounds, and can run like him. Again, he's very light on his feet, and I think he's a rock-solid late one, early second-round pick that will be the type of guy with his quality and size, the type of old-school running back that you can give the ball 20, 25 times a game to.
Okay. Another name I wanted to get your opinion on, this guy gets to see, he got a lot of hype, going into the national championship game, Trey Mason.
Love Trey Mason. I would worry a little bit about the wrist, you know, for a running back as often as they use their stiff arm and use their hands, I'd be a little bit worried about that. Also, he had a little bit of a tendency to dance around a bit in the games that I watched. But I'll tell you, if you want to find a guy in the old Mike Shanahan zone scheme trademark, which is put your foot on the ground and get upfield, I don't think there's a better guy in this draft to do that than Trey Mason. Because as soon as he finds a hole, he explodes through it like a cannonball being shot. I really like his physical ability. The two questions I have other than the injury are, you know, playing that run-first scheme in Auburn where it seemed like, you know, a lot of when you're running for 400 yards, you would certainly expect your running back to put up big numbers. And then my only other question for him would be, you know, what type of receiver he is, because Auburn barely threw the ball to the wide receivers and tight ends, let alone the running backs. So we're not sure how he's going to be on third down, but if he has good enough hands to catch balls out of the backfield and he's able to pick up blitzes as far as pass protection is concerned, then I think you're looking at a rare guy that can stay out there for three downs and get you a lot of big plays in the run and screen game.
And for all you old-school hip-hop fans, I just learned this, actually. Trey Mason's father is one of the members of De La Soul. I had no idea that. That's kind of interesting. But anyway, Brian, another player I was really curious to get your opinion on is Jeremy Hill from LSU.
Jeremy Hill is another guy. Him and Carlos Hyde are almost like clones. They're about the same weight. They're about the same height. They both have very similar running styles. Personally, I like the LSU kid a little bit more than Jeremy Hill. I think that he was able to have superior production where he almost averaged 7 yards per carry in the SEC, which is, of course, renowned for what? Great defensive teams and a lot of future pros, the defenses that he was going up against. So I'm a big fan of him. The one question mark you have to have, though, is that this guy was 50-50 to even play this year at LSU because of an off-the-field incident, a bonehead mistake, where Les Miles actually had the team vote on whether or not they would reinstate him for the season. So there's certainly some questions that have to be answered. I'm sure teams and scouts have done their homework on him. And as long as the character aspect checks off for it, I mean, this guy is a redshirt sophomore, so he still has a lot of tread on his tires. And I think he's going to be a really, really nice running back in the NFL. He's as big almost as Le'Veon Bell and Eddie Lacy were a year ago. I don't know if he's as good as Eddie Lacy, but I would compare him favorably and might even like him a little bit more than Le'Veon Bell, a guy who had a really nice rookie year out of Michigan State for the Pittsburgh Steelers a year ago.
All right. Is there any other running backs that intrigue you before we switch over to quarterback?
Yeah, there is. A couple guys I really like, and it's sort of like whatever your cup of tea is. There's a guy that was a late invite to the Senior Bowl named Charles Sims. He's from the University of Virginia, where there's a transfer there. And this guy caught more passes than most wide receivers do in their college career. So if you're looking for a shotgun back and a guy that can screens and protect your passer and run out in the flats and make some things happen, pick up chunks of yards and move the chains, you know, I think he could be a wonderful complementary back. Bishop Sankey from the University of Washington, he's the type of guy that, again, if you can't root for this guy, then there's something wrong with you. He was more than willing to take the ball over and over again for a pretty average Washington team a year ago. He had a remarkable amount of touches, yet never seemed to wear down and actually seemed to get even stronger as the season went on. The only thing I think that's holding him back from being an early second-round pick is I think he's the type of guy that's good at everything but not great at one thing. He doesn't have that one. You know, whether it's physicality, speed, whatever, I think he's one of those guys that's just a solid all-around player but not elite at one certain thing. Devontae Freeman, a scat back from Florida State, he shared time with another running back, that an interesting day three guy, James Wilder Jr., who's cut out of like Carlos Hyde and Jeremy Hill at 230 pounds and 6'3". I mean, he's humongous. But anyways, back to the guy I really want to talk about, Devontae Freeman. He's going to be this year's Andre Ellington, I think, a guy that's really going to surprise folks and help out an offense right away as a guy that's going to pick up big yardage both out of the run game and pass game. And then lastly, two more guys that I absolutely love. My personal favorite running back in the draft, I don't necessarily think he's the best running back in the draft, but Lake Seastrunk, the running back from Baylor, who Mike and I talked about him a week ago, I mean, if you want explosive big players, this is your guy. He was originally a transfer from Oregon during the Chip Kelly era. And if you went to Oregon as a running back in the Chip Kelly era, you better believe you're able to blow up stopwatches. And the last but not least, my personal favorite, David Flewellen, Lockport native from Toledo. Give this guy a chance. The guy averaged over 6 yards per carry his last 2 years of his college career. Can help out in kick and punt returns. Type of guy you take in the fifth, sixth round. Let him sit behind a starter for a year or two, and in 2 years you might have yourself a starting running back in the NFL.
All righty. I mean, everybody else listening, you know, go back and listen when this shows up on iTunes and rate some of these names down. Brian Shipley doesn't miss often. Now, I'm remembering when we were working together, Brian, I remember you were beating the drum of Jerome Harrison. You're like, yo, this guy, Jerome Harrison, is going to be a beast. He's going to be a beast. And you know, you weren't saying, like, you know, career potential or whatever, and it wasn't even a drafting. You're like, look out for him. And then he had those, like, three straight weeks where he just was crazy, and he was the biggest waiver wire pickup in midseason fantasy football in 2000, I think it was 2009 or 2010 season.
Yeah, that's right. It was Cleveland Brown.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, just Brian doesn't miss everybody. Like, get your pen and your paper and just write down everything Brian's saying. Regurgitate it all back to your friends, and you're going to sound like a genius. So, all right, we're switching to quarterback now. And like I said, we're going to limit our Johnny Manziel talk. My only question about Johnny Manziel, Brian, is where does he go? What team takes him?
Honestly, I think it's going to be a team with the owner that squeezes the general manager and the coach and says, let's get this guy in. He can change the face of the
franchise.
Oakland.
Okay, so he's
going
to Oakland.
Trying to predict what Oakland's going to do is the ultimate fool's errand. I really have no clue where he's gonna go. I mean, he's personally not a favorite of mine. Earlier, I thought it would be Cleveland, but now a lot of respected reporters around the league are saying Cleveland's certainly not going to take him, at least with their first round pick. There's a lot of smoke as far as the St. Louis Rams are concerned, and some people think that this could be Jeff Fisher's new age Steve McNair, but I don't know. I don't see it. I'd rather give Sam Bradford another chance and maybe take a developmental quarterback later on. I hate to be speechless, though, but I have no idea where that guy's going to go tomorrow. Nothing would shock me. If he went top five, I wouldn't be shocked. And if he fell out of the first round, I wouldn't be surprised at all because I've never thought of the guy as a first-round quarterback. So there's really nothing that would surprise me tomorrow, which makes me a sellout for not taking a stand, but I really have no clue.
No, and it's so weird. He's such a polarizing player. I don't understand it. Like, I don't understand, like, what on the field has proven him to be it's a foregone conclusion. He's going to be the first quarterback taken, and I didn't see anything on the field where I was like, man, this guy translates to the NFL. Like, I saw it with a lot of players, but I you know, from my amateur eyes, I never saw it with Johnny Manziel. Like, he's made great plays. He runs around. You know, he was exciting in college, but I just didn't understand. I see no Andrew Luck in this guy. Zero. Nothing. I see nothing that reminds me of Andrew Luck at all. And he's the prototypical, this guy is the most hyped player in my lifetime, the most hyped quarterback, you know, and I see none of this out of Johnny Manziel. I don't even see the kind of buzz that was surrounding, you know, Christian Ponder. you know, it's just, I don't know. At least, you know, I'm sorry, I worded that bad. I saw more from Christian Ponder as a throwing quarterback than I did from Johnny Manziel. And I know that's going to make me sound crazy because Christian Ponder is horrible, but I don't think I'm alone in that, but I also think people are going to think I'm crazy. So I don't know. I don't know either.
Let me put it this way, Bill. I always like to – always been most interested in quarterbacks that have a distinguishing trait. And that's why I like last year a guy that went undrafted, but I would have taken earlier – Tyler Bray from Tennessee, who had an awful personality, an awful work ethic. But, my God, the guy could absolutely sling it. He would have had the strongest arm in the draft if he came back to Tennessee for a year and came out this year. The year before that, a guy like Brock Osweiler, that was a guy I liked. Why? Because he had a big arm. Last year, E.J. Manuel, big arm. I always look for that one distinguishing trait, or at least one that you hopefully have that's going to separate you from other quarterbacks. And I like that trait to be something tangible, whether it's a big arm or whether it's supreme speed like Michael Vick had back in the day, something that's going to make you special in the NFL. And when people use words like, well, he's magic and he's a playmaker, a lot of times I think that's just a Band-Aid statement for, well, he's not that talented, but he finds a way to get it done. And that's one thing in college. It's a different thing in the NFL. And I just can't see him picking apart a team from the pocket like you need to. And these defensive coordinators are so smart. They will find a way to keep him in the pocket. And if he can't get to that next level as a thrower, which I don't think he – I think his arm strength is personally is overrated. I think that he's going to be a disappointing first-round quarterback for some team, although jersey sales and ticket sales might go through the roof.
Yeah, I agree. So, I don't know. We're done talking about Johnny Manziel, though. So, I'm going to throw
yeah, let's
in,
move
I'm going
on
to throw a couple
Johnny.
More. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're wasting too much time. All right. A player that's kind of, you know, I'll just say it, Teddy Bridgewater. You love Teddy Bridgewater. What do you see as his ceiling? Do you see him being a franchise-level quarterback? Because a lot of people don't.
Well, it depends on what your definition of a franchise quarterback is. I don't know if he's ever going to be an elite quarterback, but my word for elite stems with just, you know, 6-7 guys. But I think he can be well above average in a league that is always starving for competent quarterbacks. And you know what I do? I think he can be a franchise. Now that I think about it, I do think he can be a franchise quarterback. I love everything about Teddy Bridgewater. Before I get off on my tangent, you know, all these people that wonder whether or not he can do it against NFL defenses, if he doesn't have the arm strength, the personality, whatever, whatever. I like Teddy Bridgewater as a sophomore, but I wasn't fully sold on him yet because I thought Louisville didn't play all that great of a schedule. And what I really could not wait to see was when they played the Florida Gators in the Sugar Bowl. And on a defense that included Sharif Floyd, first-round pick last year, Minnesota Vikings. Dominique Easley would be a first-round pick this year if he didn't tear an ACL in week two. John Bostic, linebacker, second round, Chicago Bears last year. Ronald Powell, former top recruit who will certainly be drafted at some point this year. Matt Elam, safety, first-round pick, Baltimore Ravens. Roberson, corner, top three-round pick probably this season. Point being, that team was loaded with defensive talent. Not only with defensive talent, but their coach is a defensive-minded guru in Will Muschamp, who's made his way to being able to take a job, such as a head coaching job in Florida, by having stout defenses and slowing down the best attacks that college football had to offer. And this guy had over a month to prepare that defense for Mr. Teddy Bridgewater, and he shredded them like it was an early season game against, you know, one of those schmuck teams that they play on their schedule. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, head over heels, I love this kid. This is my type of guy. The John Gruden highlight where it shows where he takes it right in the chin, gets right back up and throws it. I think he's the smartest quarterback. I've read things that scouts said that and teams have said that he's done the best on the chalkboard or the dry erase board, I guess it is, in 2014 as far as teams having him go up to the board to describe what they're doing, what he's looking at, how he reads his keys, et cetera, et cetera. I think the guy's going to be terrific. I mean, if you want to throw a vertical, if you're looking for the next Joe Flacco, you might not like him. But I think he can absolutely win with Teddy Bridgewater, and I think he's going to be well above average. And if he drops as much as people say he does, I think he's going to be an absolute steal for some team that needs a quarterback and takes him later on in the draft. Because for all the flack the quarterbacks took a year ago from the 2013 draft, I don't find the 2014 draft of quarterbacks much better, if at all. But I find that the top prize in this is, without a doubt, Teddy Bridgewater, and he would have been the top prize last year, too, as far as I'm concerned. Draft him, and I think that as long as you can keep his weight on and protect him, he's going to be just fine in the NFL. What do you think, Adam O'Bell? Are you down on him like the mob mentality right now, or what?
No. You know what? Those workouts are silly to me. It's the game. It's when bodies are flying around, how poisoning you in the pocket, and I don't think there's any prospect that I saw that looked better in the pocket when there was pressure and faces and hands coming at them. So
right.
Those private workouts
Doug,
are silly.
Can I interrupt you?
Yeah, go ahead.
That's a great point, because Doug Whaley was at the pro day. He's the GM of the Bills, and I heard him say how bad he felt for the kid, because he had five throws he said they were just awful. And he goes, you watch, ESPN, the other networks are just going to go bonkers over those five throws and ignore the fact that he completed the other 60. If that wasn't a prophecy,
yeah,
then I don't know what was. And they always say the best pro day ever, Mike Mack always says. was Jamarcus Russell. So that should tell you about how much of a predictor of success that pro days are, and I just don't get why even a guy like Mike Mayock, who I have nothing but the utmost respect for, is just putting so much stock into it. And I like Teddy just as much as I did at the end of the season when everybody thought he was going to be a top five pick, and I think he's well worth it, an early first round pick. But sorry to interrupt you, Bill.
No, 100%. You're 100% dead on. It doesn't matter. Like, I could look good throwing the ball in shorts and a t-shirt. Like, I'm nowhere near the level that any of these guys are. But it's so silly to judge somebody based on that. It makes no sense. They don't play
the words
football.
Of Allen Iverson. We're talking about practice.
Yeah, exactly. Listen, I love that quote, by the way. There's a lot of merit to that quote. Anyway, we're not even going to go off on that. I can't believe he took that much flack for that. But anyway, regardless, it's silly. It's beyond stupid. Like, it's just, Jamarcus Russell, why even have him? If Jamarcus Russell's the best pro day you've ever seen in your life, I think that should make all pro days null and void, and they shouldn't even have them. Private workouts, you know, whatever. If teams want to see him in person, to be these pro days, I mean, I understand it's a big deal. Everybody goes out there and sees them. But, you know, is Jamarcus Russell the greatest quarterback that's ever lived? Absolutely not. He's not even close, obviously. And it's silly. He's the highest paid quarterback maybe that ever lived, but
Pro days are so overrated for quarterbacks. I think they're important for every other position, because if you're a corner like Joe Hayden and you run awful at your 40 at the combine, then you have a chance to atone for that at your pro day. Or if you did poorly at positional drills, again, you have a chance to atone it. But for quarterbacks, I just don't think it matters, because ultimately it comes down to what are you going to do when you have live bullets coming at you in game, and the pro day tells you nothing about that. So even though I do find the value for other players, I think it's just certainly overrated as far as quarterbacks are concerned.
Yeah, you're 100% spot on, and I don't know. If you're going to judge a quarterback based on their pro days, then why even watch game footage? Why should they even play in college? I mean, it's such a cerebral position. It's one that the difference between Blaine Gabbert and Peyton Manning is how their accuracy. Bridgewater is really accurate, and their poise under pressure. Bridgewater is really good under pressure. I don't know. It's silly. It's absurd. But anyway. Brian, enough with Bridgewater. We're going to move on from him. Let's talk about a couple of these I don't want to call them tweeners, second round and beyond type guys. Guy that you made me watch, just based on your raving about him, his release, Jimmy Garoppolo. What do you see him doing as a pro?
Well, I think he's going to need a redshirt year to learn and pick up the speed of the NFL and practices and training camps and preseason games and whatnot. But this is a guy that rapidly improved over his time in Eastern Illinois, excuse me. And again, I go back to what I saw at the East-West Shrine Game and Senior Bowl week when A.J. McCarron almost inexplicably turned down a chance to go out there and compete, giving Jimmy Garoppolo a chance to go in there and, in my opinion, leapfrog him as far as who's going to get drafted first. And this guy, I'm not saying he has a quick release for draft standards. I think it might be one of the quickest releases I've ever seen. I mean, he just flicks the wrist and the ball is out. He has good feet, seems to have a good head on his shoulder. I think that this guy would be an ideal fit for the Cleveland Browns. Maybe not at 26, maybe they trade back, maybe they get him early in the second round. But I think guys with quick feet, quick releases, where the downfield throws aren't vital, are perfect in the Shanahan boys' offense. I think that this guy would be terrific with Kyle Shanahan running the boot action fakes and running those quick slant throws that they like to do so often. And not to mention that when he does have to throw it deep, he can just throw the jump balls up to Josh Gordon and Jordan Cameron and let him come down with it. If I was Cleveland, other than Teddy Bridgewater, this is certainly a guy that I would really, really think hard about, maybe using my first two picks on the best position available. And then with my early second-round pick, giving myself a guy that I can develop behind Brian Hoyer this year, and then in the hopes that if he looks like he's going to be the guy, we're set. And if not, I only spent a second-round pick on him, and it doesn't take me out of the quarterback market a year or two.
What about a name that's starting to pop up a little more and more now, Tom Savage from Pitt?
I'm just not buying it. I mean, this was a stock where the stock has it's like a stock that no one heard about, and then the stock for everybody's jumping up and down with money in their hands trying to get in on it. I'm just not buying it. I mean, I watched Pittsburgh play a couple times this year, and I don't remember once thinking, like, wow, who's this quarterback, man? He looks like a potential stud in the NFL. Like, I would be somewhat surprised if Tom Savage was anything more a guy like a Derek Anderson type, a guy with a big arm that at times looks like he could be a star, and then three throws later, you're like, what is this dude doing out on the field for us? So I think he's going to have a nice Derek Anderson-like career where maybe he starts for a year, has a good season, but overall it's going to be a long-term backup based on his terrific arm strength and ability to at least throw the ball down the field in case something happens to your starter.
All right. What do you think about Zach Mettenberg? He's gotten into a little trouble recently with his diluted drug test there, which is, I don't know. I don't put any stock into that stuff. That to me is silly. And that's a whole other issue we don't need to get into, but that's something that I believe football players should be allowed to do. Without getting too specific, just given the grind of the sport, just let them do it. What's the hurting? It's legal in two states. It's, in 30 years, we're going to look back and say, and I'm just going to go on a soapbox real quick, a very short one, but it's going to be legal, and we're going to look back in 50 years and be like, I can't believe that marijuana was illegal. It's stupid. I don't care that he had a diluted urine sample. The fact that it's taken up like a couple of blogs from Roto World or a couple of blurbs from Roto World is enough to make me nauseous. So, Zach Mettenberg on the field. What do you think, Ryan?
Great. Well, as far as Mettenberg, 2 years ago when he first took over the LSU job, I mean, he just looked awful. He was staring down throws. He was throwing balls away. He was throwing head scratching balls. This year he greatly improved, but he's a guy that I would not want to take too high and wouldn't want to do anything other than a developmental guy that could be a future backup and a possible future starter. But the guy's coming off the torn ACL injury, and he already looks like he has cement shoes back there in the pocket. And the guy that comes to mind when I think of him is a guy like Kerry Collins or Drew Bledsoe that, yeah, they can sling the rock. But I think in today's NFL, you got to have a guy that can at least move a little bit, just a little bit. You know, just slight movement in the pocket. And I don't think Mettenberg is that type of guy. You know, he played under Cam Cameron last year in a pro-style offense. So I do think there's a place for him in the NFL as maybe a future lower-end starter slash quality backup. But I'm just not buying this idea that the teams have him as high as people thought they did, at least before the diluted sample came out. So I'm not a huge fan, but I could see why a team would want to take him in the second or third round.
All right, and go ahead. Sorry. Is there any other quarterbacks that you want to talk about before we move on?
Well,
I'm
going to sound sort of like a hypocrite here because I just praise Teddy Bridgewater, even though there's some arm strength questions. But generally speaking, you know, a lot of people think arm strength is overrated. I actually think it's underrated because I like to compare it to a pitcher in baseball. And when a pitcher in baseball has a velocity that can reach 96, 97, they can get away with leaving the ball up in the zone, throwing it right down the middle because they threw the ball so hard that a guy still swung through it, maybe contact, follow the back, whatever. Whereas if a guy leaves that ball up in the zone in the same place but only throws 89, 90, well, guess what? That ball is 10 rows deep in the bleachers right now. Similarly, I think in football, arm strength lets you get away with more. It allows you to be late on throws. It allows you to fit balls to tight windows. It gives your guy a chance to get a ball that maybe a weaker arm quarterback wouldn't be able to throw down the field, like a chance for a jump ball and a big play. Where I think a guy with less than stellar arm strength, sort of like Ryan Fitzpatrick for the Bills a few years ago, everything has to be perfect schematically, and the receiver has to gain a lot of separation. And that's just too asking too much on the wide receivers, the offensive line, and the coaching staff in the NFL. So for that reason, guys like A.J. McCarron and Aaron Murray, who had terrific college careers, well, they just don't interest me at all because I don't think that they have the arm strength needed to ever be more than a okay backup in the NFL. Lastly, a couple of guys that do interest me, mostly based upon their arm strength, but also because they can run and move around a little bit, which is something that I love in my backup quarterbacks. I love guys who can come in, scramble, move the chains in a variety of ways. One of them is going to be Taj Boyd, who reminds me sort of a shorter Donovan McNabb in the fact that he's stocky. He can run some, but he always looks to pass first. He had just a prolific career at Clemson. When he runs the ball inside the red zone for first downs, he puts his shoulders down like a running back. And I think if you get him with the right quarterback coach and help iron out some of his accuracy issues and pocket issues as far as not going through all his progressions, I think you have a guy that could potentially be a starter a few years down the road, but at the very least be a nice backup quarterback. And then lastly, a guy that intrigues me a lot, who a couple of years ago looked like he'd be a first overall pick in the future, and that's Logan Thomas from Virginia Tech. He's 6'6", 260 pounds, and just a ridiculous athlete with ridiculous arm strength. But came to Virginia Tech as a tight end, still pretty raw at the position. But if I'm a quarterback coach, I'm clamoring for my team to take him in the mid-rounds of the draft and give me a chance to develop him. By all accounts, he's a great kid, good head on his shoulder, really loves football. His teammates at Virginia Tech loved him. So for those reasons, he's the perfect type of guy to bring in as your third or second quarterback and develop him around a quarterback that's set in his position. So I guess those are the guys that would interest me versus the guys that wouldn't interest me.
All right, Brian. For the next, for the rest of the positions, we're going to kind of shotgun them here. We're not pressed for time, but you know, time is a factor here. So what we're going to do is I'm going to give you positions. I'm just going to let you talk about the guys that you want. I'll chime in best as I can. I don't even hold a candle to kind of knowledge you that funny, but all right, I'm going to let you go. Wide receiver, tight end, guys you like, guys you dislike, the whys, all that fun stuff.
Right. Well, as far as wide receivers, obviously we've spent a lot of time on the podcast talking about Sammy Watkins. I don't think we really need a rehash, but again, not to toot my own horn, but I just love my comp for him, which is a mix between Percy Harvin and Randall Cobb, and that guy is just a star in the NFL all day long. Mike Evans, another guy we spent a lot of time talking on. I'm really interested to see where he goes. I had questions about it at long speed prior to the combine, and he ran a terrific time at the combine. I think he'll be a top 10 pick and a solid NFL wide receiver. A guy that we talked about in the beginning of the draft process, who I thought that would make a perfect fit in the Patriots' offense if they targeted him in a trade-off, is Odell Beckham Jr. I still believe that. He seems to be gaining a lot of steam lately as well. He's renowned for being one of, if not the most polished route runner in the draft. Terrific, terrific athlete. Kind of reminds me of a more explosive than his prime, Greg Jennings. The way this guy first was on my radar, a real quick story, was I read the book Friday Night Lights over the summer, which that book was written almost 30 years ago. But anyways, in the book, the school that the author followed had to play a high school in Texas with the number one recruit on their team. That number one recruit was Odell Beckham Sr. So, of course, I knew about his son, and I really wanted to track him this year, knowing he comes from good bloodlines because his dad also played at LSU. But more to the point, his dad met Odell Beckham Jr.'s mother at LSU, who also happens to be a world-class track athlete and was a track star at the college. So, I mean, if you're talking about perfect bloodlines, anything less than the Matthews, I think that would be the type of bloodlines I would want in the first-round pick.
That's an evolved human being. He's the kind of guy that's like, this is how I think of Russell Westbrook, too. That's the kind of human that will be walking around in 500 years. That'll be a very average human in 500 years. They're just these guys, the description like what you said, I think Darren Collison's another guy like this, and it's just crazy bloodlines, just walking around more athletic and more evolved than the rest of us. So, that's right. A great story. I think you've told me that before, and I like hearing it. So, go ahead with the rest of them.
Yeah, Junior is just such a sick athlete, but he's also understands the nuances of the game, because like I said, his father played at a real high level as well, and I think he'd make a terrific pick for any team looking for a wide receiver in the top 15 or 20 picks. Brandon Cooks, the short guy from Oregon State, another terrific route runner that comes from a coach out in Oregon State and Coach Riley, who spent several years in the NFL with the San Diego Chargers, comes from the Don Coryell School of Passing, which he was basically the inventor of the modern NFL passing tree, not Riley, but Don Coryell. So, again, he's going to be a polished route runner that can come in, and he's just so explosive. He reminds me of a less explosive by a little bit, but a better route runner and receiver than Tavon Austin, who went eighth overall. I think he's going to have an instant impact in the NFL, either as a slot receiver or a situational deep threat. Lastly, Marquise Lee had sort of a disappointing combine, ran a 4.5, which isn't devastating, but when you add in that the guy had a lot of drops and he's under 6 foot, 200 pounds, he doesn't seem to be as elite a prospect as maybe people thought after his monster 2012 year. But I still think he'd be a very interesting guy to take at the end of round one or beginning of round two. I just think if you think you're getting a future number one, you're fooling yourself. But I think he can be a good possession number two receiver. As far as guys that I'm not overly high on, I'm going right to the Big Ten. Allen Robinson, the wide receiver from Penn State, I think he benefited from Bill O'Brien coming there and opening up things in the passing game. You know, although he is a better athlete than your typical Penn State wide receiver, I'm not overly high on him. Cody Latimer from Indiana has been gaining a lot of steam, maybe all the way up to the first round. I like Lattimore as a sleeper, but I think if you're taking him in the first round, again, you're going to be disappointed if you think you're getting a number one wide receiver. And then real quick, a couple sleepers. Dante Moncrief, wide receiver from Ole Miss, 6'2", 4'4", 40, probably a second-round pick. He has the physical tools to become a number one wide receiver. We're not really sure how good he is because Ole Miss quarterbacks had college football back a few years with a poor play a year ago. So we're not totally sure how well he's going to transition to the NFL. But he has a skill set needed to do well. And then Sammy Watkins' teammate, Martavius Bryant, who's 6'4", 250, and can run in the 4.4s and jump out of the building. Again, another real nice skill set. Had a lot of drops, had a lot of inconsistencies. But if you get him with a white wide receivers coach, I think he could be a potential number one wide receiver down the line. And lastly, Brandon Coleman, 6'6", from Rutgers. I just love big, tall wide receivers who can go up and get it. And this guy was the focal point of the Rutgers offense. Probably going to be a mid-round pick, but I think he could be more successful than other receivers that tall have been taken in recent years, such as your boy Ramses Barden from the New York Giants. On to tight end, if you're looking for tight ends this year, I think that there's really the big four prospects everyone talks about. And I think if you're looking for, there might be a couple sleepers in there, but I think if you don't get one of those big four prospects, I would just totally ignore the tight end position until late in the draft. The big four, of course, are Eric Ebron, who we've talked a lot about. My personal favorite, Troy Nicholas, who, in my opinion, is the second-best tight end in the draft after Ebron. 2 years ago, was playing outside linebacker, a ferocious blocker, 6'6", 260 pounds, real good route runner, can go up and get the ball, has decent speed, but was unable to work out at the combine. And I think he could be a potential steal in the second round. Austin Seferian Jenkins from Washington coming down off a down year 2 years ago. Had a big-time season, though. Late first, early second round for him, and he's certainly an interesting prospect as well. And then, of course, Jacob Marrow, who, even though they call him a tight end, the guy was, I never once saw him with his hand in the ground at Texas Tech. He was always lined up in their spread offense, but he's a terrific receiver. And should be a nice chain mover, sort of like Zach Ertz was for the Philadelphia Eagles a year ago, a big play, stretch the field tight end. And then real quick, a couple sleepers. Like I said, the tight end position is not really deep this year. Two guys, though, that I like, A.C. Leonard from Tennessee State, a former mega big-time recruit from the University of Florida, kicked off the team, has obviously off-the-field issues, but I mean, the guy just looked like an absolute specimen at the combine, and that's the type of guy in the 6th, 7th round that I'd be more than willing to roll the dice on. And last but not least, Colt Liera, who has even more off-the-field problems than A.C. Leonard could ever dream of in Florida. He quit and then was kicked off the Oregon team for cocaine issues. But a lot of people thought that, you know, had his head stayed on straight and he continued to progress the way he was playing, he was a future first-round tight end. So maybe in the 7th round, if you're hoping to hit a grand slam, might be the type of guy you give a shot to, because if he messes around or his heart isn't in full cares anyways.
All righty. All right, we're going to move on to offensive linemen. Maybe the week before, Greg Robinson from St. Louis, you know, just as a guy, he's one of the, you know, four elite talents in this draft behind, you know, the other three very obvious.
Right.
But outside of him, guys like Taylor Lewin, people are talking about his off-field stuff. Like I said, that stuff, unless it's kind of, you know, ridiculous stuff, it doesn't really bother me as much as it does other people. But that's a guy I would like to get your opinion on. I mean, he's projected to go to the Bills in a lot of mock drafts. What are your thoughts on him?
I like Taylor Lewan a lot. I mean, everybody gives Jadeveon Clowney a lot of credit for that big hit in the Michigan game in the Outback Bowl a year ago. But if you watch the game for the majority of the time, he didn't have that great of a game, and that was due in a large part to Taylor Lewan. I think he plays with a nice, nasty streak. So I think he kind of gets labeled with a stigma as like an overachiever, try-hard guy. And then you saw him blow up the combine as far as, you know, he had a terrific 40 time, moves around like a oversized tight end out there. And I think he's a top 12 pick all day long, regardless of what draft year it is. And I'd be really happy if my team ended up with him. So I like him a lot. You know, we talked about Zach Martin, a guy that a lot of teams have been saying that they think he could play pretty much any position on the line. He does have short arms, which always concerns me as far as offensive line prospects are concerned. But I think you give him a shot over at right tackle or left tackle, if those arms prove to be too big a problem, he can't hold it down. He's got the nastiness and the physical attributes needed to move inside and be an all-pro level guard. And I think that your New York Giants will be tickled pink if he was on the board at pick 12.
That's exactly who I'm hoping we draft. I mean, that's a guy that I love his versatility. The Giants, McAdoo, I like what I've seen from him as far as, you know, what he did with Green Bay, you know, those guys, people will say like, oh, his job is really easy because he had Aaron Rodgers. I would argue that it's more difficult when you have a guy like that because he makes you look a lot, he can make you look a lot better than you actually are. So there's kind of the expectations of me, and I think that could, force you to be a little more creative, kind of set yourself apart a little bit. So, I don't know. But Zach Martin, I do like that he can play all over the offensive line. I think that's good with the off-injured. I don't know what the Giants training staff does, but all I know is we're constantly banged up in the line every year. Eli was hit a ton last year, so I like Zach Martin's versatility a lot. I'm not a big Will Beattie guy, so I would love Zach Martin as a Giants fan.
Yeah, that would certainly upgrade their line, and like we said, the versatility, you know, he could help them in a variety of areas depending on what they do with the rest of the draft and who shines in training camp and preseason and whatnot, too. You know, of course, Jake Matthews is the definition of consistency, and, you know, he's a guy that he's going to step in right away and be an above-average tackle in the NFL. Two guys I think will get drafted higher than anybody has anticipated are the Tennessee tackles. Antonio, a.k.a. Tiny Richardson, which is just a great name for an offensive lineman. Another former
college
that looks, he looks the part, but I think his teammate, Juwan James, is a better prospect, though. But, you know, either one of them I think will go in the top half of the second round, and both have the attributes needed to be a future NFL left tackle. Another guy I like, well, I shouldn't say I like, but another guy I think is a sleeper, but has major, major, major off-the-field concerns, is Shontrell Henderson, a left tackle for Miami. Well, if you're going to draw up a left tackle, he would look a hell of a lot like Shontrell Henderson, another former top recruit, played at Miami for mostly off-the-field reasons, some injury reasons as well. Went to the Senior Bowl, had an up-and-down Senior Bowl week. But then, unfortunately for him, he recently tested positive for a drug test, and he couldn't finish out a workout because he was, quote-unquote, dehydrated, but really it just looked like he was out of shape. So, again, he's the type of guy, though, sometimes with these big guys, all they need is that right O-line coach to get the right message and to get the most out of them. And later on in the draft, I think he'd be a really, really interesting guy to take a flyer on and see if he can get that natural ability out of him.
All right. What about a guy like? Let me go back up here. I want to see where he's projected. A guy like an inside guard. Xavier, and I'm gonna
right.
destroy his last name. Tua Filo.
Tua Filo. Great job, Xavier Tua Filo. I'll tell you what. I'm scared off by him, not because of anything that he's done, but a few years ago, a guy that I did miss on that I liked a lot was Danny Watkins. And I'm not even saying they're similar guys, but it's probably not fair at all to Xavier. But I feel like when these guys who are 26 years old are going back and playing against 18- and 19-year-olds, I don't care how good a specimen these 18- and 19-, 20-year-olds are, I think that 6 year difference gives these guys a major edge and maybe makes them look a little more physical and a little more nasty and a little more tough than maybe they actually are. Because, I mean, 6 years is a major difference. You know, a lot longer time to put on the man strength, put on the weight. You know, obviously they're going to take a more mature approach. So because of that, and he's a guy that looks like he could go late first, early second, I just don't think I ever want to take a guy that's 26 years old that late in the draft. I mean, even if he becomes you're ultimately hoping you can find a guy that can become a starter for 8 to 10 years. You look at a guy like that, he's already going to be 36, 35, 36 by that dream time frame's over. So he's a guy,
yeah,
based on where he's going to go in the draft. I want to take him, and again, it's probably not fair to him, but I just think that sometimes it's not fair that these older kids are able to come back and play against younger competition as far as looking and their attributes to the next level. A guy who I do like who could be a major sleeper, who was looking like a near lock to go late one, early two, is Brandon Thomas from Clemson. Played left tackle at Clemson. A lot of analysts thought he was going to be destined, though, to become an outstanding guard in the NFL. And unfortunately, the poor guy was at a private workout with, I think it was either the Jets or the Eagles, and tore his ACL. So if you ever wonder why teams turn down or why players turn down workouts in the future, I think that's a good indication why. I mean, if you know you're going to be a top 10 pick, I don't see why you'd ever want to risk something like that happening. So unfortunately for him, he tore his ACL not too long ago, so he's probably not going to be able to help out next year. But he's a guy that you can take, do sort of like the Niners did with Lattimore a year ago, stash him on IR, let him learn the playbook inside and out, and then hope in 2015 he can come in and compete for a job. And then lastly, another guy who heading into the Senior Bowl week was projected to be one of, if not the first guard taken, and then Aaron Donald, the D-tackle from Pitt, who I'm sure we'll talk about in a little bit, just absolutely abused him at the Senior Bowl. And that's Cyril Richardson. But I still think Richardson's an interesting guy. He's huge. He's physical. He's the type of guard that I feel like a team like the 49ers and Seahawks would be all over. He's not the type of guy that Mike Shanahan, or type old lineman, the smaller, shiftier guys. He's not going to interest teams like that, but guys that want big maulers, he is the type of guy that will interest them. And I think he could be a nice potential starter sleeper pick in the fourth round.
All right, we're going to switch to defense, Brian, and for time's sake, because, like I said, you're just a wealth of knowledge, man, and it's insane how much you know about this stuff. I know tomorrow is your Christmas, so I'm looking forward to texting you during the whole thing. Yeah, man. And if you don't get a job at ESPN by the end of this podcast, then I have no faith in ESPN or anybody else that is paying you to talk about this stuff. So, for time's sake, though, we're going to go give me, I would say, I have a couple opinions as well, but, I mean, we all know how everybody feels about Clowney. You're the guy. I was getting texts from you that I was excited to read about Khalil Mack in that first game against Ohio State. Did he get 2.5 sacks, like 8 to 10 tackles, something like that? I know he holds records for, you know, tackles for a loss and forced fumbles in college football. I mean, the guy's an absolute stud. Now, I'm reading a lot of things. Gil Brandt from NFL.com thinks that Khalil Mack's going to get drafted before Javidian Clowney. What do you think about that? Do you think that he's a prospect worth getting drafted before, you know, this guy that's been hyped for 2 years?
Personally, yeah, I would personally take him over Clowney, but I think as far as whether that happens tomorrow, it depends on who's making the first pick. I think in Houston's defense, which Romeo Crennel likes to run the traditional 3-4, I don't really see where Clowney fits in that, because he always seems, when I've always envisioned him as a player, I've always envisioned him as the prototypical right end that goes against the left tackle and attacks the quarterback off the blind side, hand in his dirt, and you just leave him there all game, maybe move him around to get some favorable matchups. But I've never pictured him as an outside 3-4 backer. Whereas if you look at Khalil Mack, and you can, that's exactly what you picture him as, a 3-4 outside linebacker and a Von Miller sort of fold. So I think that he is actually a better fit for Romeo Crennel's defense, because not only can he get after the passer from the edge, but he can also go out in the flats and cover running backs, as we've seen. We see him make interceptions. We see him affect pretty much every level of the defense. So I think Romeo Crennel had his way, and the Texans take the player that's best fit for their scheme. I think they're going to take Khalil Mack. Now, that said, of course, Jadeveon Clowney has the athletic ability to fit in any scheme, but personally, I think if the Texans make that pick, right now I would predict that they would take Khalil Mack.
All right.
As far as I like him more than Clowney, like I obviously know that Clowney has sensational athleticism, rare athletic ability. But when we talked about this before, I don't know if it was on the podcast or not, but if you look at the guy that led the NFL in sacks the last 2 years, last year it was Robert Mathis from the Colts, and the year before that it was Von Miller. And they have a trait that I think all the premier pass rushers in the NFL have, which is that insatiable desire to do whatever it takes to get to the quarterback, play their tail off, get to the ball, just that nonstop relentlessness. J.J. Watt has it. Mathis has it. DeMarcus Ware has it. Von Miller has it. And I just don't know if Jadeveon Clowney has it. And I think he's the type of guy that when he sees a favorable matchup or he sees a tight end or something on him, that's when I think you see him go all out hard to make those big shot plays and get to the quarterback. But sometimes I wonder if he has that just nonstop motor where he gets 3 or 4 sacks a year on almost pure accident just by hustling his tail off like you see Mathis do each and every year.
You know, I heard a good term for Khalil Mack that I didn't really notice until I heard it, but his bend, he has great bend. Like when he's going around a corner, how he can maintain his balance while sort of getting his body in position to kind of take away the lineman's leverage. It's something I've never really thought about or noticed, but it's a great, great, I think, indicator on these outside pass rushers that make them so fantastic, these stand-up guys. Like Von Miller has it, obviously.
Like Von Miller has it, and Mathis has it, too. The ability to bend without losing speed, it's just remarkable to see people that big be able to do that. And I totally agree.
Mario Williams is another
example.
Right.
Yeah,
Yep. Go ahead, Tyron.
So as far as the top of the draft, though, is concerned, I think that's where it's going. A lot of people have kind of hated this year on the pass rusher. What's the word I'm looking for? The pass rushing depth in this draft. I actually think, though, it's a little bit underrated if you look hard enough. A couple guys that I really like as a second-round pick, so I think could become maybe not premier feature pass rushers, but solid, chip in their own amount and get to the quarterback on a consistent basis. One would be Marcus Smith, the pass rusher. Looks like he's going to be a prototypical 3-4 outside backer from Louisville. As much as I love Teddy Bridgewater, he wasn't the only reason that Louisville turned their team around. Marcus Smith was a major reason why as well. DeMarcus Lawrence, who had a terrific combine, absolutely looks the part from Boise State, had tons of production, has great athletic ability, and another guy that I think can be a double-digit sack guy in the NFL. I also think he's a sleeper to go in the late first round of the draft to a team that might need him later on. Maybe the 49ers take him as insurance policy for Alden Smith. He's a guy that really interests me. Trent Murphy from Stanford. I hate to make the interracial comparisons, but the white guy, typical white guy, I'm going to compare him to Jared Johnson, the former outside backer for the Baltimore Ravens and now the San Diego Chargers. Just a guy that, again, doesn't maybe get to the quarterback as much as you like him to, but he's stout against the run, goes after it every play. There's just an all-around solid starter on your team. And then two other guys I just want to talk about. Dee Ford, who obviously made major bones this season at Auburn, led the SEC in sacks. I don't know if you're ever going to want that guy starting against a run-first team, maybe like a Seattle, but my gosh, I mean, if you're just talking about pure athletic ability to get to the passer, I mean, he's your guy all day. And I think, again, somebody late in the draft, maybe the Saints that could use a little pass rush help, I think he could be an ideal fit there. And then last but not least, my super-duper sleeper, Aaron Lynch, who is from South Florida, who was a top-tier recruit for the University of Notre Dame, came in, was their best defensive player as a freshman, but destined to be a future top-10 pick, had a lot of sacks for him, decided to transfer because he wanted to be closer to home for his girlfriend, which turned out to be probably an awful decision for his career because he went to South Florida for a year, didn't have a great year statistically at all. But again, this guy has top 10 ability. Something I learned a long time ago when looking at players, you can't scout a box score. If you look at the stats, you're not going to be very impressed. When you look at his athletic ability and you look what he did as a freshman in Notre Dame, and not to sound like a broken record, but I think if you get him with the right D-line coach, this guy could be a future stud later on down the road.
All right. Is there any other of those guys you wanted to talk about, those front seven guys that you wanted to talk about before we go into the secondary? Because I have a lot of questions, because it's so hard to pick between a Darrell Revis and a Anton Kaysen. So
right. Well,
who
real
else
quick,
you want to talk about?
Go ahead. A few deep tackles. I think right now the most underrated player or undervalued player right now in the draft is Louis Nix III from the University of Notre Dame. Again, another guy that you can't scout the box score. The casual fan will never love him as their first-round pick because he's only going to have 20 to 30 tackles, a couple sacks a year. But you know what he is going to have a lot of? He's going to have a lot of watches and nice electronics and other valuable gifts that his linebackers give him for eating up blocks and allowing them to get a 170-tackle season, because the guy's 240 pounds. Can really move, can really push the line. And I thought 2 years ago in the national championship game against Notre Dame, Louis Nix III had the best game out of anybody on the field. The problem for Notre Dame was the next 30 guys that had the best game that night were all on Alabama's side. But I'm telling you, that guy was pushing around offensive linemen from Alabama, all of which have either been drafted or will be drafted in the NFL, and was continually disrupting stuff in the backfield. And I think a team pick in the 20s is going to get an absolute steal. Aaron Donald, we've talked a lot about, great player, a little bit small, undersized, but tore up the combine, tore up the Senior Bowl. And then another guy who I think earlier in the season was people were talking about as a potential first-round pick, that's Wilson from Arizona State. He's only 6'1", 300 pounds, headed up and down final year at Arizona State, but a guy that I would have no problems pulling the trigger on in the second round. And if you get the most out of them, you got a guy that is a top 20 talent in the second round of the draft.
All right. What about Aaron Barr? He's a name that I heard a lot, and as we got closer to the draft, I felt it's kind of floating away a little bit. What happened? What happened with Aaron Barr's prospects? Because he was a guy I was hoping the Giants were kind of eyeballing, but not hearing as much about him.
I'm still as high as ever on him. I love Anthony Barr.
I'm sorry, I said Aaron. I'm Anthony Barr. I'm sorry. I was looking at Aaron Donald stuff on the on my iPad. My apologies.
Right. No problem. Barr is still one of my favorite players. Again, 2 years ago, this guy was an offensive player for UCLA. He's still new at the position. The reason people are down on him is because they worry that, in the NFL, you need multiple pass rushing moves in order to be a dominant pass rusher. You can't just get by with speed, as Aaron Maben learned a few years ago. You have to be able to convert that speed to power. You have to develop a second move. You have to get better with your hands in order to consistently get pressure, because if you're a one-trick pony, linemen will figure it out. But I don't think that he's just devoid of these skills. I just don't think that he ever needed to work on them at UCLA, because in college, you can get away with being a one-trick pony when you're that much of a freak athlete. So I think the guy is still... If I run a 3-4 defense, or I like undersized defensive end, sort of like the Cowboys scheme, I mean, I'm going to be all over this guy. Is someone that I think in 2 years from now, we could look back and say, man, how is that guy not a top-5 pick? Because I think he has as much natural ability as anybody in the draft. Seems to really be a hard worker that wants to get better and admits himself that he needs to work on that second move. So I'd have no qualms whatsoever. Somebody took him in the top 10.
All right, and is there anybody else you wanted to talk about before we move on to the secondary?
Real quick, Kyle Van Noy from BYU, who I thought if he would have came out a year ago would have been a first-round pick. Now he's probably going to be a second-rounder. Just a real steady Eddie, solid player that helps you in a variety of ways. He's good against the run. He'll chip in 5 to 9 sacks a year. Just a real solid player that you never have to worry about. Jeremiah Tuchu from Georgia Tech, another pass rusher, second-round pass rusher that could potentially be a double-digit sack guy. And then my sleeper, who I absolutely – two guys, actually. One guy is a sleeper that I love, Adrian Hubbard, who's 6'6", 250, looks like a William McGinnis clone from the University of Alabama, pass rusher, edge setter, probably going looking to be a day three pick, but I think could be there's a lot of untapped potential there that Nick Saban surprisingly wasn't able to get to. He came out early, probably could have stayed another year in college to help his stock, but to each his own. And then lastly, quite possibly the best physical specimen in the draft, this guy is really not a sleeper anymore, but that's Ryan Shazier from Ohio State, who is as cut up as there is. Looks like he has negative percent body fat, 6'1", about 235 pounds, ran a 4.4 40 at the combine. So he's not just a work and a warrior. He had over 120 tackles last year, over six and a half sacks, and double-digit tackles for loss. The guy is, if you don't make him have to think too much, you just let him go run after the ball. I think he's going to be a stud, and I would not be surprised at all if he's a top 25 pick tomorrow.
All righty, and we're going to get into the secondary a little bit, Brian, because, like I said, this is a position that is it's very different. It's a weird position because it's kind of like it seems like it would be a young man's position. Like, you know, it's a very athletic position. There's a lot of conditioning that goes into it, but players generally don't seem to get good at cornerback until their third year. And I have, for me, and you're going to help me with this because I don't get it. How does somebody like, we'll say, Kareem Jackson, all right, how does Kareem Jackson or D. Milliner, somebody like that, how are they different watching them work out than Darrell Revis or Akeem Talib?
Well, it's funny you ask that because Mike and I were talking about this on the podcast last week, and I think I think corner might be the toughest position to predict as far as guys going to the next level, because you assume it's just going to be the people that are most athletic in the draft are going to turn out to be the best corners. But I don't think that's true, and I think one of the reasons that Richard Sherman was able to secure the contract that he was able to secure was because there's a lot of nuance to playing the position. There's a lot of anticipation. There's a lot of film study that goes into it as far as he's looking at wide receiver movements, looking for clues from their routes in order to jump the route, get in the right position to play. And most importantly, what I mentioned to Mike, and this might not be the best analogy, but you watch a guy like Darrell Revis, and he plays under control, looks like he's jogging next to the receiver the entire time, has terrific balance, and just never seems to be panicking. Where you see guys that are superior, quite frankly, physical talent, but they look like they're running with their head, like their hair's on fire because the wide receiver was able to set them up with their route. They got that little bit of separation, and now they're on their horse trying to catch back up. So a lot of times I don't think there's a certain baseline that you have to meet in order to be an NFL corner from an athletic standpoint. I think what separates the good from the great ones is balance and the nuances of the position. And that's why I said you would think it's a young man's position, but it really isn't. And, you know, ultimately I think that's what separates guys that get taken early, like a Kareem Jackson who was a superior athlete but never really became, anything to write home about for the Houston Texans, where you see some of these lesser athletes become great corners because they understand the nuances, they understand angles, they understand leverage, and they understand how the receiver and the offense is trying to attack them.
All right. Who do you like in this draft at the cornerback? There's a lot of buzz about about Griffin. Bad pod again, Brian. Bad pod. But who do you like at the at corner?
Yeah, my favorite one without a doubt is DeQuiz Denard from Michigan State. In the Big Ten championship against Ohio State, I thought he was the best player on the field. Most of the time when I watched Michigan State, I thought he was the best player on the field. The only loss Michigan State had a year ago was to Notre Dame, and Denard was just tremendous in that game. He reminds me of Antoine Winfield, a guy that plays with terrific balance, is super savvy out there, but also comes up and is willing to pop even as an asset in the running game because he's not afraid to tackle. Another guy two other guys look like they should be going to the top 20 tomorrow. One is Gilbert, the corner from Oklahoma State.
That's who I was trying to think of, yeah.
Right, and again, this goes back to our whole thing about athleticism. This is what I was telling Mike about yesterday when I put him on my, or last week when I put him on my potential bus list, because I think, yeah, this dude is a supreme athlete. But I also see him get torched a lot in college. You saw a lot of inconsistent play. And you just, you have to wonder, is he the type of guy that was just able to get by being so much more athletic than the guys he was going up against, that he never really learned the nuances of being a corner and all the small, minute details that can be the difference between giving up a big play or intercepting a ball and going the other way. I mean, that said, he does have terrific ball skills. I mean, if you were looking for a Pat Peterson type athlete in this draft, he is that guy. So if you believe that he's going to do what it takes to learn the nuances of the position, then you might take him as your first corner. If you have those questions, though, then I would have to really, really think long and hard about whether he was too risky of a guy to take with a top 20 pick. Kyle Fuller had a good workout at the combine. He's a guy that has really been gaining a lot of steam because he can do pretty much anything you want a corner to do as far as playing receiver's face, play off a bit, hit guys. He seems to be a solid all-around corner and a guy, again, if people were surprised about him being a top 15 pick tomorrow, I would not be surprised at all about that. And then I'd say the last two guys that have been talked about as possible first-round picks, one I thought was one of the most disappointing players in the draft, or excuse me, in college this year. That's Bradley Roby from Ohio State. He's a guy that, you know, basically I choose which games I want to watch based upon which teams have the best pro prospects. And he was the guy that I was most looking forward to watching this year from the corner position. He just got lit up repeatedly for Ohio State, looked like a totally different guy this year. But still, he has that rare athleticism that you look for, but I certainly would not be willing to spend a first-round pick on him. And then the last guy is Jason Verrett from TCU, who, quite frankly, I'd never heard of until he absolutely tore up the combine with a terrific workout. Did a little more research on him. Kind of reminds me of Asante Samuel, who's not afraid to tackle. He's a guy that's shorter but not afraid to go up and get the ball. And I think if you're talking late first round as a guy that can play either slot nickelback or on the outside, I think teams like Seattle, Denver, San Francisco, who is in dire need of corner help late in the draft, I think this guy's a pretty darn good bet to go late first round.
All right, now we'll go to safety because again, safety seems to be a position that it's weird because it's kind of a hard position to evaluate because you see players that get a lot of sacks, but then they look like crap like in the run game or vice versa. The very obvious example of being a one-dimensional safety is Dante Whitner. Now, do you see any guys that a lot of people like that could turn out to be a Dante Whitner type where all they do is just smash but can't cover anybody and they cost their team chances at Super Bowl?
No, what I find interesting this year about the safety class is I think it's a lot like the tight end class. I think if you get a safety early and you go after one of the top four prospects, I think you're going to be pretty happy with your selection because I think at the top it's really, really a nice group. But I think if you're looking for a second, third, fourth, fifth round safety this year, I think you're going to be disappointed because there's not too many guys after the top four that I'm interested in. Ha-ha Clinton Dix, in addition to having the best name in the draft, also has the best game from the safety position in the draft, in my opinion. He's a guy that can cover a lot of ground on the back end, played in an intricate NFL system defense for Nick Saban at Alabama. I think he's going to be a day one starter. And I like him more coming out of college than his former teammate Mark Barron, a top 10 pick a few years ago, coming out of Alabama in a lesser draft where he went seventh overall of the Bucs. Next guy, Calvin Pryor from Louisville. To answer your question, there was a guy that has the highlight reel hits, but there's questions about his coverability that could become that one-dimensional guy. It's probably him. Oh, my God, I mean, if you don't get pumped up watching this guy hit people, then I don't know whoever will pump up your defense because he knows when to lay the wood, and he seems to be a good enough athlete where I think he can become at least a decent enough center fielder where he's not going to kill you back there if he's left alone with a tight end or has to cover the deep half of the field against a wide receiver. And then the other three guys that I like, Deion Buchanan from Washington State, had a lot of interceptions, made a lot of plays out west for Mike Leach's squad. he's probably a second-round pick that can be a free safety or a strong safety, big, strong, and another heavy hitter. If you're looking more for the center fielder type that can cover a lot of ground, can cover slot receivers, can make plays on the back end as far as chasing down wide receivers and making interceptions, and I think you really like Jimmy Ward, another one of my favorite prospects from Northern Illinois. And then lastly, and I've always kind of had an affinity for safeties going way back in the day to Steve Atwater and Ronnie Lott, so that's why so many of these guys are my favorite players in the draft. But lastly is a guy that played some corner, but mostly played safety for Florida State, and that's LaMarcus Joyner. He's a little undersized. He's under 190 pounds. He's short. He's pretty fast, but not a burner. But, my God, I mean, if you watch the national championship game, there wasn't three players more impactful that night than LaMarcus Joyner. He blitzed a lot, covered guys. He hit. He's not afraid to hit in the running game despite being that small. And he's the type of guy, again, that I think can come in and make an impact in the NFL defense from day one, where really, and most of the time, you're going to be out of the nickel anyways. And he seems to be that perfect mix between can tackle like a safety but can cover like a lower-end corner.
All right. Anybody we missed, you think, Brian? Any guy you want to talk about that you think we might have skipped over? Anybody you thought about during the show that you want to talk about?
There was a one super, super deep sleeper that I wanted to talk about. George Atkinson III, a 6'2", 220-pound running back from Notre Dame that's an absolute burner. His father, George Atkinson II, obviously, was a longtime Oakland Raider and still coaches in the league. His brother's currently a corner for Notre Dame, and I thought this guy really got a raw deal last year. Notre Dame brought in a couple of top running back recruits. They had a transfer. He quickly fell out of favor with Brian Kelly, but at the very least, you draft this guy in the 6th or 7th round. I think he'll be one of the best kick returners in the NFL next year. He had several big, long returns for the Irish this year, and his biggest problem as a running back is he's so tall that he runs high, and obviously that makes you susceptible to big hits and injuries. It doesn't allow you to break as many tackles. But I think, again, if he gets working in the right system and you let him work out in space, I think he can become a terrific playmaker out of the backfield, not only running the ball, catching the ball as well. And if I was looking for a running back in the 6th, 7th round, that's the type of guy I'd be all over. How about
right,
you, anybody
Brian,
that you want to talk about?
Go ahead. Yeah, no. In 100% honesty, Brian, I've learned more doing this show than I have any of my research leading up to this, anything I've been watching on ESPN. Brian, you are fantastic at this. This is your wheelhouse, and this really needs to just be a special. I think we need to do like a 5-hour show. I wish we could. I wish we had the ability to get you somewhere where a million plus people can hear you, because this was all fantastic. So, no, Brian, I got
really
nothing else, man. Hey, I'm telling you right now, I ask you questions about this stuff because I know that I'm getting the best possible answer from the best possible person that I know that does this stuff. You're absolutely incredible, Brian, and I'm going to keep heaping praise on you because you're just a wealth of knowledge that that man, I don't even, you know more about the NFL draft than I know about my own life. So it's very, very impressive, Brian. But no, man, that's it. I mean, I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to be watching every minute of it tomorrow. No Twitter for me before any of the picks, because I was doing that last year, and it, you know, ruined a lot of the fun for me. So I'll be tweeting after the fact, but yeah, I'll be texting you most of it, and our mutual friend Sean, and obviously Mike, and I really look forward to watching it. So I did want to tell everybody to go ahead and follow me on Twitter at Bill Kegel, and follow Mike Pozeski on Twitter at Mike Pozeski. That's at Bill Kegel, BILLKEAGLE. And at Mike Pozeski, BSP, excuse me, Mike, PESESKYBSP, and follow Brian, me, and Mike on Facebook as well. And go ahead and tell a friend about the show as well. We're trying to get more ears. People need to hear what Brian Shipley and Mike Pozeski have to say, and they need to hear. You know, they can probably go out here most of my shows.
The Grizzlies are going to be from Bill Kegel.
Oh, listen, no worry. The closer we get to the NFL season, I have a nice segment that you guys are going to enjoy. It involves me and Eli Manning, so be prepared for that when we get closer to the NFL season, because I got a lot of defending to do, a lot of ammo in my defense weapon is weaponry against the hate that just comes at my Lord and Savior Eli Manning. So look forward to that. She, you know what? I think she's come to terms that she's sharing me. So, but we'll finish the NFL tournament of Mike. We got the Bills and Steelers so far next week. So look forward to that. And Brian, you got anything else?
No, I think that looking forward to the draft tomorrow. It should be a great weekend, and can't wait to see how it unfolds, because I think it's pretty tough to know. Usually by now we know pretty much who the first 5-6 picks are going to be in some sort of order. This year, I mean, we know the top four are probably going to go in the top five, but it seems to be a lot of trade chatter and a lot of ambiguity surrounding that top 10, so it should be a really exciting night tomorrow. And of course,
yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Right, my favorite day is that day three, rounds 4 to 7, where you can really find some gems that can really add great value to your team. Guys like, Cam Chancellor for the Seahawks is a day three pick. And, of course, that Friday day, or rounds 2 and 3, that's where you really see a lot of trade activity, and that should be a lot of fun to follow, too.
Yeah, it should be a lot of moving and shaking tomorrow, over the weekend. So looking forward to that, looking to see what the Giants do, looking to see what the Bills do. Always have my eye on the Browns. I always have my eye on the Broncos, with you being such a fan. And hopefully we can figure out a team for Mike to root for and their draft, I guess, after the fact at this point. But yeah, man. All right, well, this was fantastic, Brian. Like, I learned a ton. I have 3 pages of notes here. I'm looking forward to it. So till next week, Mr. Shipley, I'll talk to you then.
Sounds good. Thanks, Bill.
All right, buddy.